Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. One of the biggest challenges to protecting, restoring, and managing significant urban natural areas and critical fish and wildlife habitat is the notion that cities are bereft of significant wildlife or the habitats that support them, that urban biodiversity is an oxymoron. This morning, we discuss local, national, and international efforts to reverse that promise and what governments, NGOs, and others are doing to promote ecosystem and human health, access to nature, and biodiversity in cities around the U.S. and internationally. We are joined by frequent Locus Focus guest Mike Hauck, director of the Urban Green Spaces Institute and board member of the Intertwine Alliance, David Maddox, who's founder and director of the Nature in the Cities program in New York City. Now, that sounds like an oxymoron right there. And Chantal Van Ham, who's from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature in Brussels, Belgium. Mike, David, and Chantal, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, this is the first show that I've ever titled with oxymoron on the word, so I want to thank Mike for that. And by the way, we actually are gathered here today to wish Mike Hauck a happy 70th birthday. So happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
And we won't sing.
No, good.
I guess, actually, one of the things that really struck me as I was looking over the notes was thinking about New York City as having, you know, any thoughts about biodiversity. No, actually, a number of years ago, I was up on in a penthouse looking out over the city, and I saw a peregrine falcon flying around. And I'd heard that there were peregrine falcons in New York, just as there are in Portland. So I have recognized that New York is kind of reclaiming its nature. But as in, how do we bring together the idea of a city as dense as New York with the idea that there can actually be nature existing there? Because I lived in New York 50 years ago, 45 years ago, and nature was very, very hard to find back in the 60s and early 70s.
I guess it depends on a little bit on what you mean by the idea of nature, because first of all, I'd like to say that our organization is called the Nature of Cities, in the sense that we're talking about nature and green spaces, but also the character of cities. Now, we can think about the place like New York as being very dense, very gray, but there's an immense amount of nature interstitially in the city. Street trees, parks of all kinds, of all sizes. The ocean is right there. So there are many different types of nature. Is it a giant national park, a wilderness? No. But we can imagine that there are parts of nature, little bits here, little bit there, that add up to important elements of nature in a couple of ways. One is that supports biodiversity in various ways. And also it supports the livability, resilience, and sustainability of New York by adding up in an aggregative way the idea of nature here, nature there, that adds up to a greener city that's better for everybody and better for nature.
Well, actually, I saw a lot of that developing when I spent a lot of time in New York over the last 15 years. It was really different from when I lived there. But one of the thoughts that I had living in New York, and actually still I feel that way now, is that there are barriers to nature. It used to be when I was living in New York, you did not go into Central Park at night. It was very terrible things would happen if you did that. And in fact, one time when I was coming from some event and on the east side, walking over to the west side, and I think we found about 20 people for an affinity group to walk through Central Park. So the idea that the center of nature in the city is off limits after dark and had a really horrible reputation, the idea you wouldn't even walk along a park on a sidewalk at night, and that also a lot of parks were receptacles for all kinds of nasty things. I think about Law and Order with all those bodies that are found in Riverside Park and Fort Tryon Park. So that I wonder, has that changed? Is New York, is in a way, integrating the human experience with the natural areas? Are the natural areas still kind of these no-person lands, which are deemed as very dangerous and kind of not hospitable for any kinds of socialization?
I think you wouldn't recognize, if that's your impression of New York, you wouldn't recognize it today, because it's a very different place. Central Park, I've walked in Central Park at night now. It's a city, so like many cities around the world, you need to be careful about, be aware of your surroundings. But one of the interesting things about Central Park in the era that you talked about, 1980s, it was a difficult place. New York was a difficult place. There was a decision at the time, some interested people around Central Park decided that they wanted to make the park better, and they created something called the Central Park Conservancy. A lot of people outside of New York don't, and I suppose a lot of people inside New York don't know that Central Park is not actually managed by the city. It's managed by a public-private partnership called the Central Park Conservancy. They raise an immense amount of money around Central Park, because there's lots of very rich people who live around the park, to fund the management of the park. It's a big organization. Now, one of the things I think we'll end up talking about today is this idea that if we think of urban nature, green space, as if people like us really believe that urban nature is a good thing, and we spend a lot of time talking about the benefits of urban nature, then we also have to ask ourselves the question, who should have access to that urban nature? And the answer is everybody. So in that sense, green is an environmental justice issue. And the Central Park Conservancy raises some of that question for New York, because these very wealthy people who want to invest in their park, their local park, which happens to be Central Park, good for them. There is the question about, in the poorer neighborhoods, who's going to invest in those parks there? Because the people in those neighborhoods don't have this much money to be able to invest in their parks. The city should do it. So there is a big question in New York City right now about the idea of who should be supportive of the idea of developing open spaces, democratic spaces, green spaces in the city. It needs to be some combination of the city, private groups, private investment, and what I mean is community investment, people who are gathering together in communities to make their neighborhoods better. So there's a constellation of different kinds of efforts in New York that have been really important and transformative about the idea of green space. So I think my point is that we have to change our conception of exactly what we mean by nature in cities, because we're trying to create better cities for everybody, people and nature, which is everything from the street tree to the bioswale, to the park, to the regional park, and so on. And that's the kind of thing we're also seeing around the world as well, that are struggling more with the idea of green space. Places like Mumbai don't have the open space, but there are people trying to move the idea forward about green space, open space, democratic space, to make the cities more livable.
Well, Chantal, let's move over to Europe. Now, I have limited experience in Europe compared to my extensive experience in New York City. And the only country I've ever really spent time in Europe was Italy. And there, what struck me by the cities was that there's no nature, except like I was in Florence, for example. And there's a beautiful garden, but it's completely separated from the city. And you go into the public spaces and they're just all paved over, or the cobblestones. There's not a single tree anywhere. Is it different in Brussels?
Well, Brussels is quite a big city in European terms, and I think an interesting example is that if you see the metropolitan area of the city, 50% of the plant species you would know from Belgium occur in Brussels. So that's, I think, a positive sign. There are also green spaces more around the city, but I think that what you've seen in Italy shows also the need that we have to restore that connection between people and nature. So IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, is a global organization, and we work together with members, both national governments and NGOs around the world, to really protect biodiversity and to show what the value of nature is, and especially how it can help to address societal challenges like securing drinking water supply and reducing flooding problems, improving air quality. And we do also see that cities that are leading the way are those that value and protect and celebrate their green spaces and their nature. Because in the end, if people don't have that connection, they will not protect it in the future either. And we believe, as an organization that was focused initially very strongly on pristine nature areas, that working with cities is essential for our future, also in showing that connection between the city and its wider landscape. For example, cities around the world really depend on nature areas for clean drinking water.
Well, actually, cities around the world depend on natural areas and just rural areas to feed ourselves as well. And let's get to Mike now, and let's get back to Portland. And when I first came to Portland, there seemed to be very little distinction between the city and the natural areas around it, because the city was about half the size that it is now, and there was very little suburban sprawl. And I think people in Portland had a real connection to the landscape, and it also was reflected inside the city. Actually, when I came here in the early 70s, there were lots and lots of vacant lots and kind of feral trees growing, and it felt like a kind of wild landscape. Now, I'm wondering if Portland has some lessons to show larger cities that have not, if Portland's, say, its awakening as a city and as an urban center, which I think happened sometime in the last 25 years, if the fact that it's had this historical connection to natural spaces and to the rural landscape around it, if that is a way of leading the way for other cities to understand the importance of nature in the city.
Well, It cuts both ways. David and Chantal are here because we're actually this week talking about the concept of putting together an international gathering to discuss all the topics that we're going over now. And we undoubtedly, well, just through the process of planning with the 25 international guests that we have here from all over the world, including Mumbai and France, and David can let us know who else is here.
But Seoul, Melbourne, Kampala, Cape Town,
Bogota,
lots of people. Yeah,
yeah. We will learn a huge amount from all of these international guests, but it cuts the other way. And I think that we have experiences. We were out in the field yesterday, for example, at South Waterfront, Heron Point Wetlands, and one of your favorite places, Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge. And I was trying to just tell the stories behind how those places came to be protected. And so I do believe when we've had guests come here that they have benefited from being in Portland. But we sometimes, in my opinion, tend to rest on our laurels and celebrate things that occurred 20 years ago.
Oh, like the bottle bill.
Right, exactly.
1973, right?
And we have a lot to learn from other cities around the world as well. So it's a mutually beneficial arrangement. So we're meeting for a day and a half at Portland State University to plot, and David can give more detail on what the plan is. But the idea and the reason I invited them to Portland was we have what I think is one of the more interesting bioregions in the world, with Vancouver, Seattle, and Portland, the Emerald Corridor. Hoping that might be, if not a meeting here, international meeting 2018, maybe one of the several regional meetings that we might pull together, again, so people can exchange information, best practices, and inspire one another. Really, that's what a lot of it is about.
Actually, speaking about international gatherings, I just want to throw this out and politicize this for a moment. We were supposed to have a guest on the show who, she was traveling from, remind me, the Netherlands.
Yes.
And unfortunately for her, she had recently been to Iran, and so she was denied a visa by the Trump administration. So I just want to throw that out. This is the first direct experience I've had with watching the kind of chill that the Trump administration is putting on international gatherings and exchange of information and learning opportunities, and just kind of a chilling fascism that's creeping over.
Well,
and
two people. Yeah. We actually lost two people. And Francois last night mentioned that all of his electronic equipment had to be shipped. He couldn't bring it on the plane with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was actually PK.
Was
Das
it PK
from Mumbai?
Das?
He was traveling from Dubai.
Oh, right.
And it was part of the new rule that nobody can bring computers on the plane.
Right, so you can't work when you're on the plane.
Yeah.
And then I would love to ship my computer in baggage. I think everybody wants their computer to go through that kind of mishandling. And that is really has more to do with competition with the Middle Eastern airlines than it has to do with any kind of security. But that's another topic.
Yeah. Let me throw in one last thought, and then we can move on. I'd be curious for your listeners to hear a little bit more about the nature of cities as well. Your question, I believe, as I recall, was do people still have the same connection to nature as they did, say, back in the 70s? I think actually it's a bit more intense these days, simply because the city and the region has grown so rapidly. And, you know, there's an adage, follow the money. If you want to know what's behind something, the taxpayers in this region have taxed themselves three times now, twice to raise money to acquire natural areas, 17,000 acres at Metro, $363 million. And even more amazingly, recently they approved a levy to provide money for operation and maintenance, management of those areas. That's virtually unheard of around the country. People throughout the U.S. could not believe that Portlanders and people in the Portland region would tax themselves for O&M money. So that's a testament, I think, to how much people do care about having access to nature.
Well, if you're just tuning in to Locus Focus this morning, we're talking with Mike Houck, who you just heard, who's the director of the Urban Green Spaces Institute and a board member of the Intertwine Alliance. David Maddox, who's here from New York City. He's founder and director of the Natures of the Cities program in New York. And Chantal van Ham, who's from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature in Brussels, Belgium. And we're talking about the importance of biodiversity within cities. Back to the 70s for a moment. when I came here, the idea of going to see nature or be participating in nature actively was to get out of the city and to go up to Mount Hood or the Gorge or the coast or Mount Adams or Mount St. Helens before it blew its top. And that's, I think, something that's changed a lot. And Mike, you're somebody who's helped me to appreciate I live next to an urban natural gem, so I feel very fortunate. But you and Steve Johnson, some other people, talked about the importance of reconnecting with nature within the cities. And that's, again, where I think Portland is a real gift. And I still think, I mean, I try to think of a place in New York City where I could go and experience what we experience in Forest Park here or in Oaks Bottom. And actually, Oaks Bottom is an example of a place that was just a mess. I mean, it could go along with probably Fresh Kill, the Meadows, whatever that place is called, the big dump in Staten Island. And it was kind of a small-scale version of that before Mike and the neighborhood spearheaded a campaign to turn it into a very viable wetland. And now, when I go into Oaks Bottom, I often see more wildlife varieties than I do when I go up in Mount Hood. So it gets to two things. The importance of how do you create not just places where there's trees growing and maybe there's a few hawks flying around like in Central Park, but you actually have a really viable ecosystem within the city that supports, I don't know, how many species are there in Oaks Bottom?
Over 100.
Yeah. And you can sometimes see them all in one day. So
we were watching bald eagles yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah, they're flying over my house now, actually. there's a whole new generation of bald eagles down there, and it's and that's another thing we can talk to you about. It's like the kind of experience that urban dwellers have when you see bald eagles flying over your house. But first of all, I'm wondering how far along both Brussels and New York are in actually creating or recreating natural spaces that really are in themselves kind of almost viable ecosystems.
Well, maybe from Europe, there are some good examples. Europe actually gives an award every year, the European Green Capital Award. And one of the cities that won it some years ago is in the Basque Country in Spain, Vitoria-Gasteiz. And they've developed this green belt around the city, on the one hand to help reduce flooding problems and erosion, but also to really create beautiful spaces for the citizens to enjoy, but also to enjoy for visitors who are coming. And that has really given a very positive reaction by the people who live there and also the visitors.
So is the green belt, is that a natural area that was there that's being protected, or do they tear down urbanization and create a green belt?
It was actually different areas, former industrial sites, agricultural land, existing nature spaces. There's even protected nature sites in that corridor. And they all connected it in such a way that it circles around the city, but also connects with the green space within the city. And I think that is a really nice example, which shows that, nature is given attention. And the city also planted a tree for every citizen, and in that way, making it very symbolically part of people's life. It's part of policy to make every citizen able to be close to nature. So within 800 meters of your home, there should be nature. And I think that is really essential if you want to bring nature back into people's life. And it has so many positive benefits for health and well-being, would reduce costs on the health insurance in many ways. And there's quite a number of cities in Europe that are following that path with all the positive benefits that it brings.
Well, with concerns about climate change, which is a subject that Mike promised that we talk about today, I'm thinking about Hurricane Sandy. And in the aftermath of that, I read some interesting papers that were proposing softening the hardscape of Lower Manhattan and turning it back into a wetland, something I know that Mike would really love the idea of that. And that's one of the things that we've been struggling with in Portland, too. There was a big debate about dealing with our combined sewer overflow problem, and some people who really wanted to focus largely on restoring the wetlands along the Willamette River banks, and other people who didn't have patience with, even environmentalists, who didn't have patience with that slower process, and just so now we have a big pipe. But we're still hopefully restoring the wetlands as well. In New York, I mean, one of the things that I've noticed, I learned about when I was spending a lot of time in New York in the last 10 years, was sort of reclaiming the tidal flats around the Rockaways, mm-hmm. and all these areas that were just seen as wasteland back in the 60s and 70s and probably long before that. So those are two things I want to throw out to you. Is there a possibility of tearing down Wall Street and turning it back into a wetland? And what's happening out in the far Rockaway area?
there may be social reasons to tear down Wall Street, but the environment is not one of them. The Housing and Human Development, HUD, had a giant funding program called Rebuild by Design, a big competition in which different designers and ecologists and social scientists teamed together in a competition about planning a post-Sandy New York, a more resilient New York. And one of the things that was really an unintended consequence or a benefit of Sandy, if you can call it that, is an increase in the passion about the idea of resilience. And there's ecological resilience and there's also social resilience. And both of those things started to develop in New York City and in a very important way after Sandy. One of the winning projects, in fact, was from an organization called SCAPE, a landscape architecture group. And their idea is to re-green the southern edge of Manhattan, around the southern edge of Wall Street, including redeveloping the oyster culture of New York Harbor. But the projects happen all around New York City. Around the Rockaways was horribly devastated by Sandy, and many of the first responders who responded to the devastation around the city actually live in Rockaway. So it was a terrible irony. The Rockaways has had an immense reinvestment of social resilience, community groups, including in some of the NYCHA housing, the community housing in New York City. In the Rockaways have invested in community gardens, memorial gardens, wetlands that are face the sea for them. And that's an important aspect of making sure that we think of the benefits of the environment. We think of the classic green space, biophilic kind of benefits. But there are also benefits in terms of resilience. And we need to make sure that everybody in the city has access to the kinds of benefits we believe that ecosystems provide in the resistance to storms. So in New York, for example, we have a $2 billion plus a bioswale program that's being put in place. The places those bioswales are going are designed to be places that are otherwise underserved by natural elements. And the benefits are, in terms of stormwater management, that's an important benefit. But there are also important benefits about just the idea of having a bit of green space, because it makes the place nicer. It calms traffic as well. There are all kinds of benefits that we need to make sure that those benefits, if we believe them to be true, are distributed around the city. And that's been part of the New York City plan, to actually green areas of New York City so that we are more resilient, both in an ecological sense, but in a social sense as well.
Well, Mike, do you think any examples in Portland that New York could learn from as far as that goes?
I don't know about New York learning from us, but basically everything David said, we're trying to replicate here. We have the climate action plan, but we also have a separate plan that is has been integrated into the climate action plan called adaptation climate preparation strategies. And getting to the issue of equity, we want to across the city increase the urban forest canopy for a number of reasons: fish and wildlife habitat, open space, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the key reasons is to address urban heat island effect, which we know in our region is going to get hotter and hotter. And it so happens that Vivek Chandas at Portland State University has actually mapped areas that are going to be the hottest, and those also happen to be areas with the least amount of urban forest canopy. So if you're trying to increase urban forest canopy across the city, from an equity perspective, understanding we want to do it everywhere, you might start out planning first in those areas in underserved communities. So it's very much about equity and preparing, adapting to climate change.
Well, I had a guest on a few months ago who wrote this book about urban forests, and she had some misinformation, but generalization. So she said that in Portland, there was a very interesting example of all the trees are on the west side, and in the east side, there were no trees. I said, well, that's actually not true. I said, it has more to do with income, but no. So, but it made me think about it. Well, if you're thinking very superficially, well, there's the West Hills full of trees, so a lot more building than there used to be there. And then there's Forest Park and Washington Park. But, and on the east side, you think about the vast expanses of industrial land in north and northeast Portland. And the climate march, the People's Climate March on Saturday, which starts at Dawson Park, I guess around noon, which is at Vancouver or Williams and Stanton. And that march is going to be going around from one toxic fossil fuel site to another in north and northeast Portland, showing the marchers where all this stuff is and that it's all in communities of color for the most part and in low-income communities. So what's the connection between all the industrial horror that has been done to communities and the lack of nature that's kind of contingent with that?
Well, in Portland, the Columbia Slough is the perfect example of, and there are examples around the country, where degraded urban waterways are in the communities that are typically low income. And the city has actually invested quite a lot of money in restoring the Columbia Slough. One reason being that they want to provide beautiful green spaces and access to nature in those neighborhoods. So I'd say we're doing quite a lot in that industrial corridor. One of our strategies at the current time, commercial and industrial lands are exempted from planting additional trees. We need to change that policy within the city of Portland and start planting trees, not just in residential areas, but also in the industrial areas.
Well, the last time I saw you was actually at a Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, I think the Land Use Committee, which you're on, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'm leaving it up to you, Mike, to do something about it.
Well, it will definitely be coming before the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and it's no secret that I would favor removing that exemption.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning to David Madden, who's founder and director of Natures of the City program in New York City, Mike Houck, who's started the Urban Green Spaces Institute. You are the Urban Green Spaces Institute, right, basically?
Well, I have a pretty active board that is engaged in a lot of the work, too.
That's good. That's good to hear. And Chantal Van Ham, who's from Brussels, Belgium, and she's with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And we're talking about the importance of urban nature. And I wanted to get now into the whole issue of how urban nature serves the cause of biodiversity, not just in the city, but how it's connected to biodiversity across the planet. Whoever wants to start with that one.
I think Chantal would be good one to tackle that first.
Yeah, as we are a very old organization founded in 1948 to protect biodiversity, our initial interest, of course, was to focus on these natural areas and give them protection, but also to develop knowledge and science on what is the status of species, plant and animal species around the world. But we see now how important the connections are between different nature areas and ecosystems. That's important for the species to survive, but also for nature to give its functions like flood protection and other of the functions that were mentioned here in relation to climate change. So we believe that cities are really part of this process. And what I think is really the issue nowadays is that there's great untapped potential in what the value of nature is. And that is why we as an organization also reach out to new partners. Cities are important partners there, but also the private sector. So we work with companies and with different sectors like the extractive industries, but also aluminium, for example, producers, to really show how you can integrate the value of nature, natural capital, into decision-making processes. And from a city perspective, I think a nice example is from Canada. It's a municipality called Gibson's, and they have now worked out a way to look at what are their natural assets. So they started with their natural aquifers, water aquifers, and valuing and measuring what they provide to the citizens, making that part of the city's budget and accounting systems. And the same goes also for companies. If they are able to look into what nature can give, and also to some extent give it a quantitative value, you're able to also engage new partners and create partnerships that find solutions that go beyond the nature conservation community.
You mentioned Gibson's. This is a city I'm thinking of on the Seashell Peninsula. It's an interesting place because that was, until recently, a pretty remote area, and it's experiencing extreme suburbanization. And the last time I went through it, I was kind of really shocked. So I'm curious about how they are dealing with protecting their watershed, basically, with all this encroaching, the malls and the housing developments that are encroaching upon that area. Are you familiar with what's going on?
Yeah, I don't know this from my own experience, but because of a process that IUCN is engaged in at the global level, it's the World Forum on Natural Capital, and that is where we bring together scientists, companies, governments, other stakeholders to really learn from each other, share experiences, and to really develop concrete actions to make that natural capital part of their decisions.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed living in Portland and actually that experience seeing the peregrine falcon in New York City is that there seems to be a lot more wildlife in cities than there was in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. And I really noticed it in Portland. And it's not just where I live close to a wildlife refuge, but in lots of parts of Portland, I'm seeing hawks flying overhead. I don't know that the eagles get all the way around Portland as they seem to spend most of the time around the river. Hummingbirds all over the city. Lots and lots of songbirds. And another interesting thing is the crows moved into the city. It was about 25 years ago, I think. The crows used to live out in Sandy, around there, Gresham, Hillsborough, and it was a farmland. And so it's an interesting thing to see. And I'm wondering, what are the reasons for why we are actually finding more wildlife living in the cities? How much of it is pressure from development around the rim of the cities, and how much of it is what cities doing things that are really good for wildlife?
Well, I wish we had good data that actually demonstrate that we could prove that is in fact happening versus perhaps it's a perception. I share your perception. I don't know if it's because I'm more aware. I spend more time looking than I did 30 years ago. But there are shifts for sure. A good example: yesterday at Oak's Bottom, we were looking at Anna's hummingbirds. Well, Anna's hummingbirds did not used to occur here. They moved in from California, in response to climate change. People used to drive 30, 40, 50 miles to see an Anna's hummingbird. Now, a walk around Oak's Bottom, you see 15 or 20.
Or my backyard, for that matter.
Right. So I don't know if we actually have more critters here now or not, but I certainly know people do notice it more.
Well, actually, we had a conversation probably 20 years ago about whether Oak's Bottom could support deer. And at the time, I think you were saying deer shouldn't come here. There's not enough to support them. Well, there's a lot of deer in Oak's Bottom. Did you see them when you were down there yesterday?
We did not yesterday. No, we didn't. I think one really critical thing is that the natural areas within the city actually do support species that are in trouble. Well, at least 30% of the birds, for example, are in decline, certainly nationally and I think internationally. So the notion that these smaller green spaces don't really contribute to biodiversity is simply not correct. And we look at our salmon, steelhead and Chinook salmon. The reason they did better last summer when salmon were going belly up along the entire Willamette River is the city of Portland, and this gets back to climate preparation and green infrastructure. The city of Portland Parks and Recreation and Bureau of Environmental Services restored a long segment of Crystal Springs Creek. Well, it turned out that the city was actually to document a decrease in temperature in Crystal Springs Creek to the point that salmonids could be supported. So it became a cold water refugium so those salmon could come in off the Willamette and experience colder water in that newly restored stream. They're threatened and endangered species. So we have peregrine falcons. 7% of all the peregrine falcons in the state nest on the bridges in Portland. So they have very real attributes, very real complement to protecting species that are in trouble in the heart of the city.
There's other things going on in the 70s, the 60s and 70s in the United States and elsewhere that relate to this trend as well. And there were bad pollution problems, DDT, that were suppressing many of the bird populations that we're talking about. So we can thank the several of the big federal acts, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, for some of that restoration, in addition to the fact that we have improved green spaces in the cities over time. I do want to wade into another question about what do we mean by biodiversity even? There's a legitimate debate in conservation circles, in urban greening circles, about what qualifies as appropriate biodiversity? Do we really care that that it's native species versus not native species? The non-native species might perform functions. It's an argument, it's a discussion about the difference between purely native, indigenous animals and plants from the region versus animals and plants that perform the same kinds of function in green spaces. And it's a particularly important conversation in conservation circles around the idea of climate change. If cities are constructed communities of plants and animals, these cities are built places. And climate change is changing so much. We're not only changing the physical structure of the cities, but the climate is also changing. Would we really expect the same plants and animals to be here as were here 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Should we continue to fight a rearguard action about maintaining what the plant and animal communities in Portland or any other city are? It's a difficult conversation, but it's a conversation we always have to have when we're making these built ecosystems that are cities.
Well, it seems, though, that there's a difference between how the plant or animal is introduced. I think about invasive species since I live by Oaks Bottom. I think of purple loosestrife, which maybe is dead. I'm not sure. I think that between the Beatles 2 summers ago and the flooding this year, it probably has had some major setbacks. But that's a plant that was introduced. It was brought here by people. It wasn't something like the Anna's hummingbirds, who I'm pretty sure came on their own.
Yeah.
The starlings, on the other hand, I mean, they came on their own here, but they got introduced into New York City, into Central Park, for that matter. So I think that I'd like to sort of parse that out, and we only have a few more minutes left. So let's maybe talk about what would be a possibly good invasive species or exotic species, and what are the ones that we still have to be very wary about?
I'll take a quick one. We are definitely hard at work here to eliminate invasive plant species, and we'll continue to do so, I'm sure. There are, I'm sure, examples, however, that would give credence to David's comment, because we know that over time, given climate change, the conditions will change, and there will be critters, plants, and animals that move in. And are they welcome? I think they would be.
Well, I'm thinking about the barred owls, you know, who are not welcome. They're wiping out the spotted owls, and so now we're going to kill the barred owls.
God.
Yeah, so it's
too complex. Right,
but that's but I think that's the problem. I mean, we get into, and I've had people. I mean, I've read arguments about this. I've had people like really come down hard on me because I'm too hard on invasive species, and there's no such thing as an invasive species in some people's minds. So it's a really bad conversation to be starting, as we have to be out of here in 2 minutes.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Any last thoughts on this before we start?
Well, no, I think what David pointed out is that these are the sorts of issues, questions we need to address through the meetings that we're planning on having around the world. Right. And these are very real dilemmas that ecologists and non-ecologists need to wrestle with.
Right. And I would say that these are conversations that have to be had in larger communities of people, larger sets of discipline, not just among ecologists and not just among planners. This is the idea of the nature of cities, and this grouping we're having this week is the idea, is fundamental to the idea of nature of cities, where we are 600 writers from around the world of all different types. We are ecologists, sociologists, activists, people interested in justice, design. We have to have these conversations about city building that include green spaces that are multifaceted. It's definitely a question in the global north and the global south as well that IUCN works on.
Yeah, no, indeed. I think that learning and sharing is key. And from Europe, invasive species, it is one of the main threats to biodiversity. And of course, very much depends on the local situation. Europe has now legislation since 2 years that will look at a priority list of species to be dealt with. I think that it's all about learning from each other and finding good solutions with all the stakeholders involved.
So Chantal and I are both on the board of the Nature of Cities, and I want to put a plug in. David mentioned the number of essayists from around the world that contribute. 600, did you say?
600 plus, yes.
It's thenatureofcities.com. And check it out. There are great essays. There are photo essays. It's really a very fascinating assemblage, diversity of views from throughout the world.
Well, great. It was really interesting to talk with you all. I'm really glad that you came here on your way to this. Sounds like a very interesting symposium that you're going to be having this week. And then we'll see you all at the Climate Justice, at People's Climate Action March on Saturday, I hope. And I just want to also do a shout out for that. Did you? You were at the March for Science, Mike.
Oh, yeah.
I got your photos. So, yep. Just one last thought about it. What do you think that march be? How that may be changing the tenor of the times?
Well, I think it's had a huge impact around the world. It wasn't just in Portland or Washington D.C. There were marches for science throughout the world, and I think it's incredibly important given what's going on.
And Le Pen still got 20% of the vote in spite of that.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, thanks a whole lot for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking this morning with Mike Houck, David Maddox, and Chantal Van Ham, who are all involved with basically looking at the nature of cities and the importance of nature in the cities. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Dan Egan, author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Milton Nascimento. Thanks for listening.
Oxinol tomou conta do meu viver. Chegou quando procurei razão pra poder seguir. Quando a música ia e quase eu fiquei. Quando a vida chorava mais que eu gritei. Pássaro Deus.